Hello and welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast for Friday 30th of August with me, Ian Welsh. I caught up recently with sustainable cellulose manufacturer Lensing's Vice President for Sustainability, Krishna Manda. We covered a lot of ground, including the challenges for companies meeting net zero milestones and targets. That's to come, but first, here's a quick roundup of some sustainable business news with Innovation Forum's Ellen Attia.
Swedish furniture company IKEA is launching a new second-hand online marketplace called IKEA Pre-Owned. This platform, currently being trialled in Madrid and Oslo, allows customers to buy and sell used IKEA items directly to each other, eliminating the need for third-party websites such as eBay and Gumtree. The initiative is part of IKEA's broader strategy to promote a circular economy by encouraging the reuse and recycling of its products, thus reducing waste and extending the life of its furniture. The company plans to roll out IKEA pre-owned globally by December, marking a significant shift in its approach to retail. One of the standout features is its zero commission policy, which allows sellers to keep 100% of their earnings with a 15% bonus when paid in IKEA vouchers. Some criticise this bonus encourages IKEA's traditional retail model, which raises questions about balancing economic incentives with genuine sustainability efforts. Despite these concerns, IKEA's new initiative is seen as a forward-thinking step in the right direction, especially as more companies, including fashion brands, explore second-hand business models. The company acknowledges that this is just a pilot phase and is open to making adjustments based on customer feedback and the results of the trial, ensuring that the model is both viable and desirable for consumers looking to make more environmentally conscious choices. The sugar industry in India is facing intense scrutiny after an investigation by the New York Times and the Fuller Project exposed widespread labour abuse among female workers in sugarcane fields. The investigation revealed that women were forced into illegal child marriages to work alongside their husbands and pressured to undergo unnecessary surgeries, such as hysterectomies for minor health issues, to remain in the fields. These surgeries often left them with severe health consequences and trapped in a cycle of debt to their employers. In response to the report, labour leaders in India staged a three-day hunger strike, demanding better working conditions, and major companies such as Coca-Cola have begun discussions with local government and suppliers to promote responsible practices. Meanwhile, Bonsucro, an industry body that sets standards for sugar production, has announced the creation of a human rights task force to investigate these abuses and improve oversight. However, labour activists argue that more decisive action is needed from the companies benefiting from this exploitative system to ensure fair treatment for workers in the sugar supply chain. Mitsubishi UFJ Financial Group, a major Japanese bank, is under fire for issuing $630 million in sustainability-linked loans to Royal Golden Eagle, a palm oil and pulp and paper company accused of deforestation in Indonesia. The recent report by the Rainforest Action Network includes satellite images that claim to reveal ongoing deforestation on Royal Golden Eagle's lands, which RGE denies, blaming local communities for the tree loss instead. While RGE states that its sustainability targets are verified by independent auditors, Rainforest Action Network argues these targets are vague and inadequate. The controversy has sparked broader concerns about the effectiveness of sustainability-linked loans, with critics labelling them as greenwashing harmful practices. This issue could affect RGE's ability to sell palm oil in the European Union, which is tightening regulations against deforestation. Despite these concerns, MUFJ maintains that it conducts rigorous assessments of its clients' environmental practices. World Water Week is drawing to a close this Friday, taking place from the 25th to the 29th of August in Stockholm. This year's theme is Bridging Borders, Water for a Peaceful and Sustainable Future. The conference aims to address the growing water crisis through collaborative efforts. A key topic has been the role of Indigenous knowledge in promoting peace and water cooperation. Stockholm International Water Institute highlighted that Indigenous perspectives are increasingly represented at the event, a positive shift from previous years. This is a timely discussion with the growing importance of corporate water stewardship to ensure supply chain resilience from water-related risks. Some businesses are leading the charge. An American chemicals company, Ecolab, has received the Water Stewardship Verified Certification from the Water Council earlier this month for its commitment to achieving net positive water impact with their conservation measures across company-operated facilities in the US. Coca-Cola, L'Oreal, and 116 global companies have also set water targets to drive progress in this area.
A couple of weeks ago, I spoke with Krishnamanda, Vice President for Sustainability at Lenzing Group. Lenzing is an Austria-based sustainable regenerated cellulose fibre manufacturer with its products used in a number of sectors, including home textiles, garments and hygiene products. We're going to be talking about some of the challenges for companies performing against climate targets during the transition to net zero. Krishna, to start us off, Lenzing has some ambitious 2050 goals. What are the headline targets?
We have a science-based target in 2019. However, it was actually 2 degrees centigrade ambition level. So we have upgraded the targets to 1.5 degree ambition level. So with that ambition, we got also science-based target verification and approval. Our scope 1 and 2 are 42% absolute reduction by 2030. And scope 3 reduction is 25% absolute reduction by 2030. And we also have a net zero by 2050 for all scopes together. So that means at least 90% absolute reduction and 10% for carbon removals. That is the way it should be. So we are one of the first cellulose fiber producers to have an ambitious science-based target.
So how important has been the impact of setting science-based targets?
It is very important if you are talking about an organization like 8,000 people with many departments, right? We all need to bring them onto the same direction. These targets help set the ambition level and direction. After that, you can actually embed that in all decisions of the different departments and functions when they are making, let's say, the strategy team is looking into expanding, right? And then what type of energy equipment and then energy scenarios they need to plan? What is the impact of that on the organization's footprint and their product footprint? So they all need to consider that. So in the case of procurement, the supplier engagement and selection should be also considering not only cost, quality, and lead times, but also the sustainability aspects. Operations colleagues need to provide emission reduction roadmaps and also implementation. Without this kind of ambitious target setting, you cannot bring the whole organization aligned in the same direction. It could be a cacophony, yeah? But it should be an orchestra and a symphony, right? All of us need to coordinate actions. Innovation plays a crucial role in the company, and they need to know what are the important parameters they're actually designing the new products and new systems for. So they need to also retrofit the new technologies to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels. I would talk about some of the levers, and they need a lot of innovation within the company. By setting a science-based target, we could guide all these different functions across the whole group in the right direction. That has been tremendous for us because we have been doing it right from the C-suite, including their governance and also incentives linked to that, and to the departmental heads and their agendas and the projects and programs.
What does progress look like then?
Just to simplify, if you can break it, the whole net zero into five stages, just to make it simplified, you have energy efficiency and purchase of renewable power and low carbon fuels like replacing coal with natural gas or biomass, the third one. And the fourth is actually there is a lot of heat and you need to decarbonize that heat. And the fifth is carbon removals. If you look at these five levers, and we have been making good progress with the first two, energy efficiency and renewable power purchase. To some extent, low carbon fuels, we have been moving from coal to natural gas in some facilities and looking into biomass value chains and those. With all these things, we have achieved around 25% absolute reduction for scope 1, 2, 3 with our supplier engagement and with some of our long-term suppliers too. The first two levers were the major drivers, the efficiency and renewable power. And to some extent, the third lever that is using low carbon fuels and those. We have been able to reduce around 500 kilotons per year now And that is equal to around 5 to 7 big brands' scope 1 and 2 emissions per year. So just one company, Lenzing is a $2 billion, 8,000 people company, but still one company is having impact of 7 to 8 big brands from scope 1 and 2 point of view. It's huge. But so far, getting there has required us to implement and also invest some CapEx and OPEX and those kind of things. But the next 15 or 20% reduction to reach our 42% absolute reduction by 2030 requires tremendous amount of CapEx. I'm talking about $3-digit million. That is the real challenge we have. And some of the options we need to choose will have a very long payback period with huge investments. The critical question is, who is going to pay for it?
Obviously, in this process, some of it's going to be a bit easier, some of it's going to be a bit more difficult. What have you found most easy and what have you found most difficult so far?
Energy efficiency is within our own umbrella. So look into which pumps and which compressors to simplify. How can you make the operations more efficient? It can be done. And you also have a payback period depending on the type of project. And also buying renewable electricity in some markets may be easier than other markets because there is a lot of duplication of the certificates in some cases, but also there is no guarantee about additionality. That means you are buying this electricity. Is it actually helping the market to grow for renewable electricity? You don't know that. We are using renewable energy certificates in some cases, but in the case of Europe, it's a guarantees of origin so that you can get on your bill what is the electricity share of different fuels and those. To some extent, this is easy in some countries, but in some countries, there is no availability of electricity. And even if it is available, it is much more expensive. These are the kind of challenges we are facing for these two pillars. When it comes to moving to coal to natural gas, for example, we are investing around $40 to $50 million in China to move from completely coal to natural gas boilers and turbines. It is really, really expensive on one hand. On the other hand, not only the CapEx, but also the OPEX, the operational expenditure is also 2 to 3 times compared to coal. The process, like to get the permits and those, like around 12 permissions you need to take from the national level to regional level to local level, just for a pipeline, for the connection, for the boiler, so you can multiply 3 times 3 or 4 times 3, 12. So you need to get all these permissions, which is like very bureaucratic. I think many countries have that, unfortunately. All these things have made it very complicated on that side. But also we wanted to install biomass power plants in some places. And it's not easy to get access to deforestation-free biomass supply chains. How can you prove that biomass is deforestation-free, right? It's not so easy. And even building a silo for storing the biomass also cost you $4 to $5 million. Just a simple, you might think how difficult it is. So all these things have been very difficult and we are still not into the real crux of the things that is decarbonizing heat. I believe that is where the biggest impact need to come from some of the companies in the world, like us as well. Like we have a 70% heat demand and 30% electricity demand. So we need to move that heat demand to electrification. That means maybe just a coal boiler to electric boilers, just to simplify. The industry hasn't been investing anything in this direction, right? We are talking about huge factories. Just to give you a feel that these are some of the challenges we need to tackle in the future.
I was interested to hear you talking about moving from coal to natural gas. That in itself isn't decarbonizing, but I guess it's making things better. Is it important for you to remember, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, and inevitably there has to be a transition?
Absolutely. That's a great point. I mean, we want it to be all perfect and tomorrow we want to implement, but there are no solutions. At the same time, there may be solutions actually, just to correct myself. However, there is no political willingness to create the level playing field on one hand, but also the businesses languishing in the current market environment and they are not willing to pay for it, right? We are going through those. So transition is needed, but we cannot drag it too long. And also sometimes when instead of going to cleaner fuels like hydrogen and those, which doesn't exist today, you might need to go to natural gas to reduce your emissions by half from coal. However, who will pay for the sunk cost of a natural gas boiler you put now and it won't work for 40 years? It may work only for next 10 years or 7 years. Then who is going to pay for those sunk costs? The transition is needed, but we also need to think about how do you get out of the transition to the real cleaner fuels with so many other things. Yeah.
It must be frustrating when you're trying to move these things forward, but other companies in the apparel sector are more reluctant to make the transition necessary. How do you characterize that frustration?
To some extent, not only frustration, but also impossible to make the progress because we rely on them. Let's say our suppliers and our customers, if they are not willing to go extra mile with us, then how can we reach our goals? So we cannot do that. And especially if the brands and retailers who are our final customers, if they have a different way of accounting and also reducing emissions compared to us also, it will create a lot of problems. Let me just explain a little bit. You know that SBTi has come up with this proposal that offsets can be used for scope 3 emission reduction for some companies, right? It is controversial, and actually the scientific community but also sustainability community is not happy at all. And we also don't support that. The reason is this. If you say a brand can offset their scope 3 emissions, but a manufacturer who is actually having the scope 1 and 2, which is brand scope 3, right? It's nothing but that. And they cannot do offset, but they have to reduce their own emissions. You have created different incentives and different rules for different stakeholders on the value chain. When you create this misalignment, what happens is that it causes distrust, and it also creates feeling of unfairness and delay of investment significantly, because our investors and their investors are sometimes the same guys. So it's in the market. And they might say that, okay, why we need to invest so much as a manufacturer for scope 1, 2? This brand is doing for scope 3 with only 2 euros per ton. Let's say, I'm just making it simple. In our case, probably we need 30, 40, 50 euros per ton of CO2 emission reduction. It will definitely slow down our path to decarbonization and net zero. And unfortunately, would also create this imbalance and unfairness in the market, means we start to distrust each other. And the system can actually collapse if we just let it happen this way, because it is saying that there is no level playing field for everybody, and especially for low carbon products and companies. Policy needs to intervene, that's why. So I look up to European emission trading schemes, but also the cross-border adjustment mechanism for CO2 prices. We need those. Otherwise, voluntary mechanisms and approach might not be sufficient. So hopefully, we go in this direction so that companies like Lenzing, who are leaders in this area, can still implement and make progress, but not at the expense of cutting down our own company's plans. Because if nobody is going to pay for it, we are not able to invest for it.
Well, let's talk a bit about your partner organizations. What's the role of your customers in driving progress in this?
To be honest, without customers on board, we won't be able to do anything. It's very critical that we have our customers' support and engagement. And we work with a lot of long-term customers. However, the ratio or the share of these very ambitious long-term customers are very little compared to the huge textile industry. When you invest in a biomass supply chain or maybe moving from coal to natural gas, it's 40 million, 40 to 50 million, and you are paying 2 to 3 times CapEx and OpEx. That means somebody needs to actually pay for these expenses. If our brand and retail customers are not willing to take that burden and share with us, I don't think we will be able to make this progress. Some customers are really ambitious and really mean it. They come to us and say that, hey, can you share us your CO2 roadmaps? And we would also like to grow our business with you. If you can show from your facilities what you are planning to reduce in the next 5 years, so probably we are having X amount of product from you, but if you can show that you will be doing it in the next 5 years, we will make it 2X or 3 times that purchase volume. So this kind of customers are really the customers we want to work with, because they have a long-term perspective, they have their own goals for scope 3, and they look at as partners rather than vendors, right? You need to change the conversation as well from transactional to more long-term oriented. So that's why I believe customers actually play a critical role to make progress. And without them, we will not be able to make what we are doing right now.
So what about your supply chain? I mean, are you engaging with your supply chain in a similar manner to tackle your scope 3 emissions?
We do have a lot of suppliers, maybe around 9,000 or even more. However, we also were able to prioritize top for engagement to ensure that due diligence can be taken care of very well. For that level, we have been looking at the top 500 to 600 suppliers. However, when it comes to CO2 reduction, we are looking at top 30 to 50 suppliers. And we know that they are bringing the biggest chunk of emissions around in the case of 50 to 60% of our scope 3 emissions, right? So we are working with these big impact suppliers. We have been working with some platforms like Together for Sustainability. And it is a platform founded by ambitious international chemical companies like BASF, ExxonMobil, and DSM, and all those. Lenzing is also part of that consortium. So what they do is that we all share a kind of our supply chains are overlapping. That means your supplier and my supplier is the same sometimes. So if you have a roadmap from them and also corrective action plan, I don't need to do. I just say that EAM has done it, so I will rely on EAM or the company, other company. We are actually trying to reduce the burden on the suppliers by engaging through this platform. So one of the platform members does conduct these corrective action programs and audits, and then we use that. In other cases, we also have our own contractual process, which includes the climate clauses. Like if you are our supplier, you need to ensure these things have been met and you need to provide us product footprint and those. In the case of product footprint also, Together for Sustainability also is making a new platform called Product Carbon Footprint. It comes with the methodology, tools and consulting and all those support. If I have a supplier, I can actually refer them to work with this. I would tell you why it is important. Because we are working with one supplier in Asia, and it took 1 year to align with them what we want them to do and how they can prove what they are doing. Just 1 year for one supplier, right? Over an engagement of 6 to 8 times and also engaging external verifiers and consultants. It's very expensive in terms of time, resources, and all those. These platforms like Product Carbon Footprint from the Together for Sustainability has the potential to reduce that burden on us, but also our suppliers. We are doing all these things with our suppliers, the top 40 to 50 suppliers only, not everybody. And we are engaging through this contractual process where the clauses of climate are part of it. The most important thing, I just wanted to leave a message to many audience, is that our suppliers are also moving towards renewable electricity and buying that, right? Which costs higher than the conventional electricity. That means we need to be willing to pay for that. If we don't do that, they cannot succeed in doing it and supporting us. The second thing is that some of the investments are really in multi-million dollars. Some has to invest $40 million to change the technology and those. How could they invest that much if they don't get any certainty and long-term commitment from me? So we has to give that long-term certainty and commitment to our suppliers, key suppliers. You need to pay for it, but also you need to give this long-term commitment. We are doing that. May not be with everybody, but we are doing with strategic suppliers. And I expect the same that my customers do to me as well. So we wanted to walk the talk, not just ask our customers to pay for things and be a long-term partner to us, but we are doing the same with our suppliers. Yeah, a lot need to be done, but these are the first steps we have taken.
Taking the apparel sector as a whole, what's the sort of strategy that you think is important to enable the entire sector to decarbonize?
At the industry level, we need to understand, I mean, there are a few things that we need to get it right. If you look at the textile industry, it is fragmented, highly fragmented. It's maybe around 12 to 15 countries are actually having a lot of value chains of textiles. And if you look at Bangladesh, they're predominantly using natural gas. That's their dependence. But if you look at India, they're using coal as the predominant fuel. Every country has its own geographical and energy-related infrastructure and landscape. So you need to look at each country differently, and then you need to come up with mechanisms to reduce emissions there. But also, depending on where in the value chain, for example, you may be a spinner just making a yarn, and there is somebody who is making a garment. So they have a different drivers. And the companies in the middle, which are making dyed fabrics and dyed yarns, dyeing and finishing is very, very heat oriented, or the heat demand is very high there, 70%, and electricity is 30%. But for a spinner, electricity is maybe 90%. You cannot have the same levers both places. So what I would say is the first and foremost is that acknowledge that it's no size fits all. You have to come up and prepare with country level and tier level roadmaps Not that it needs to be done by one actor. It should be a collaborative effort between brands and retailers and manufacturers in those specific countries, along with these initiatives like Apparel Impact Institute or Cascale, to drive that collective action. That is the first thing I would say. The second is investment. As I told you, how much CapEx and OpEx it requires for some of these initiatives, the manufacturers cannot themselves take all this burden. So there should be enough sharing of equity and risks between brands and suppliers or manufacturers. Without that investment in terms of equity for risk and investment, then nothing will happen. So that is the second thing I think we have to do as an industry. And the third is that we talked about the five pillars, the energy efficiency, renewable electricity, and moving to low carbon fuels. And the fourth one is decarbonizing heat. That's a huge piece. Decarbonized heat actually requires you to adapt your current equipment and processes and also design them and implement them or actually introduce them with scale to all the facilities in the world. This is a huge undertaking. We haven't even scratched the surface on the R&D for decarbonizing heat in the industry. Really, maybe there are a few examples, harbingers of hope you see from here and there. But at the industry level, we haven't done anything, to be honest, to find that kind of scale to do at that level. We need to launch a special fund to decarbonize heat, which takes time to develop and scale. So we need to start immediately if we wanted to reach the 2050 net zero goal. And the last one is a collective action. Brands and retailers come to manufacturers and say, this is what we want you to do. It should be better if we treat each other as co-creators and co-leads rather than I tell you do attitude. For example, you come to India to visit me. I mean, though I'm living in Europe now. You would like to ask me like, hey, where should I go? What are the good things to do? The same way, if you look at for energy as well, the people living in the country, the people operating in the country knows the country's context more than others, right? So that's why that co-creation and co-leads with brands and manufacturers is really, really important to develop the roadmaps and to design even financial instruments. I do see nowadays many brands coming together and say that they have a multi-million fund, but we don't know how those things really work and who pays for it. The interest rates are very high. And because it's also whether you are taking a loan in your own currency or euro or dollar matters a lot because you need to pay a tax on those as well in some cases. If we as a value chain come together as co-creators and co-leads, we can actually solve these problems and find the right solutions in the correct context, the context that they are operating. Just to summarize, it's a no size fits all. So we need to have tier and country specific roadmaps. We need to bring investment. That investment should have equity and risk sharing with the brands and suppliers. Decarbonizing heat requires funds immediately to achieve 2050. And the collective action, making manufacturers as co-creators and co-leads to develop the roadmaps and also design financial instruments.
Given the challenges then, given the complexity of it all, whilst on the one hand you can set lofty and ambitious 2030, 2050 goals, it strikes me that it's the roadmap, it's the route to achieve those goals that's really important. How much then do you have to focus on regularly tweaking interim goals along the way to ensure that the ultimate ambition is reached?
We don't have time to fiddle around. That is very clear. This year is one of the hottest years in the planet's history, maybe after the Ice Age. We need to be very clear that we cannot tweak too much for the long-term goal. However, you can adjust in between. For example, this year, my market is really bad. I'm not able to make the progress I want to make. Maybe I want to reduce 15%, but I only reduce 10% for that year. It's okay for me. However, you should not lose sight of the long-term. With 2030 is not even a long-term for me in the case of climate, but you cannot actually just reduce your ambition level and not doing it. I think we need to tackle it in a different way. We need to go back to, as an industry, to the policymakers and say that make the dirty fuels and dirty way of producing more expensive so that I will actually invest more in this. Give me tax incentives where I can reduce my footprint and also can improve my own bottom line. So all those things we need to look at it. I'm not a huge fan of tweaking targets in the long term. However, you can adjust in the medium term, short term, probably not even medium term, short term. So we are also struggling in the market right now and not much demand. you will not be able to implement many things. However, if you ask me that I will postpone it for 5 years, no, I will not do that. Probably I will take some actions this year. Next year, I will split some actions. I will still take the actions, the right actions in the right direction. I would not actually compromise on the goals because I'm looking at my daughter's life. When she reaches 25 years by 2030, 2040, 2050, she should not look back and say that, hey, you guys have messed it up, right? So we have to do our best and we need to bring our politicians accountable and our leaders also accountable in all parts of the world, both corporate and financial and also political leaders.
What's next for Lenzing then?
I think the biggest challenge for Lenzing will be decarbonizing heat demand. We are working with how do we electrify a few things. I mean, we haven't made much progress, but we are still thinking about how can we move away from using steam to electricity and how can you redesign your equipment and have collaboration with some other innovative universities in this area and get funding for these projects from the European agencies for funding and still reduce some of the fossil emissions we have in the company, whether we are switching away in terms of fuels in some cases, and some cases we are looking into conservation solutions outside value chain, but not as accounting tool. You need to improve not only mitigation aspect, but also adaptation aspect as well. So we are looking both. I would say if you ask me one thing, that is decarbonizing heat could be the one priority. The second one is the plan with the energy efficiency, moving with renewable electricity and low carbon fuels. We need to also do some of the activities there and we need to bring investment in those areas. So we will work towards those things.
Thank you. It's been great hearing how Lenzing is approaching these really complicated challenges. Krishna, Manda, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Jan.
Full details of what the Innovation Forum team is up to over the coming months is available online. We're going to be in Amsterdam for this year's Sustainable Commodities and Land Use Conference, in Philadelphia, talking about plastics and packaging, and in Washington, D.C. for the Scope 3 Innovation Forum. Hope you can join us. And head, as ever, to the Innovation Forum website for more analysis and expert interviews. But that's it for now. I've been Ian Welsh, and until next time, goodbye.